All right, if you would, grab a Bible. Let's be turning back to John chapter 18. Last week, we looked at the arrest of Jesus, of course, and I mentioned that one time that I was arrested. And I thought that, well, I would just go ahead and tell you the whole embarrassing story. So here goes. I was 19 years old. It was when I was in the AIM program, the Adventures and Missions program. I was doing work with a church over in Australia. And one night, my roommates and a young man from the youth group and I, we decided to go to McDonald's. Now, I don't know, don't ask me why, but we got the idea that we were going to dress up in the goofiest outfits that we could find and act really silly when going through the McDonald's drive-thru. Teenagers. All right. So, anyway, we get our food, we're pulling out of the drive-thru lane, and a bunch of cop cars with their lights flashing surround our vehicle. A handful of cops jump out with guns pointed in our direction. I thought, surely there's not an Australian law against dressing funny when going to McDonald's. But, well, they handcuffed us, they frisked us, they threw us on the ground, and they proceeded to search through our vehicle. Well, we discovered later, what had happened is that three guys in a vehicle identical to ours had just robbed a local liquor store, fully armed and everything else. I guess they assumed that they just decided to get a bite to eat before their getaway. I don't know. And I'm sure our outfits didn't help. Well, when they went through our vehicle and they found Bibles and Bible tracts, they realized it wasn't us. And anyway, when it was all over and they finally let us go, we returned to our now cold hamburgers, a little sheepish, a little shaken up. And I'll tell you, I have never again dressed up when going to McDonald's. Well, like us, Jesus was innocent, but his arrest certainly didn't end up like ours. John 18, we're able to examine some of Jesus' final hours here before his crucifixion. First at the garden, and that was last week, and then at the residence of the high priest, and that's today. And we can see Jesus' attitude and his actions as first he's betrayed by Judas and then questioned by Annas. And we can see Peter's mistakes as first he tried to defend Jesus and then denied that he knew him. Well, last week we finished with verses 10 and 11, and of course we can see here why Peter is often called impetuous or impulsive Peter. He didn't listen. See, Jesus had submitted to the arrest, and he had said to let these go their way. Well, instead of going, Peter, he decided to fight. And so he cut off Malchus's ear. How often do we get in trouble when we don't listen to Jesus? Well, back in John 13, we read about Peter saying to him, well, you know, I'll lay down my life for you. And so perhaps he's trying to make good on that boast that he'd die for the Lord. Well, after healing Malchus, which of course we learn from the Gospel of Luke, Jesus said, put the sword back in its sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it? And the cup, of course, symbolically speaking of his suffering and his crucifixion. See, it was God's will, and he had made the decision. Peter should not try to thwart him from drinking it. And so Jesus' rebuke and the fact that no real harm was done probably kept Peter from being arrested as well. And Peter, he may have felt good because of the courage that he showed, but he was going to find out later that night that he really wasn't as great as he thought. So the next scene here is at the house of the high priest, where two dramas took place. So we have Jesus before Annas and then Caiaphas, and Peter's denial interwoven throughout the passage. So let's begin here by reading verses 12 through 14 together. So the Roman cohort and the commander and officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him and led him to Annas first, for he was father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. Now Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people. Now, of course, it was unnecessary to bind him. I mean, that should have been obvious. He had voluntarily identified himself. He commanded his disciples not to resist, and then he willingly accompanied them. I mean, he had actually helped these guys to arrest him. Well, Matthew and Mark mention that at this point, all the disciples, they left. They left him and fled. And Luke specifically tells us that they brought him to the house of the high priest. Well, from what I read, Annas, he was the high priest from about 6 to 15 AD. Now, the law stated, of course, that the high priest was supposed to fill that position for life, but Annas was deposed by Valerius Gratus. He was the Roman procurator of Judea, and he was later replaced by Pontius Pilate. But it seems that Annas, he was still considered by many to be the rightful high priest, or something like high priest emeritus, the true high priest. And it's really interesting, I think, to have the Romans telling the Jews who can and cannot be their high priest. And it seems to have gone to the man who was most willing to toe the line with the current Roman governor. Well, William Hendrickson, he was speaking of Annas, and he said, "He was very proud, exceedingly ambitious, and fabulously wealthy. His family was notorious for its greed. The main source of his wealth seems to have been a goodly share of the proceeds from the price of sacrificial animals which were sold in the court of the Gentiles. By him, the house of prayer had been turned into a den of robbers." And that may have been the reason why Annas was after him, was after Jesus, you know, the cleansing of the temple where Jesus ran them out of there. Caiaphas. Okay, this guy, this was Annas' son-in-law. He was appointed by Valerius Gratus in about 18 AD after some other guys had held the office. Gratus just couldn't seem to find someone that he liked as the high priest. And that may be why John said high priest that year. Around that time, it was really hard to keep him straight. And so that year, just speaking of the year that Jesus was crucified. And interestingly, the ossuary of Caiaphas, you know, the Jewish bone box, it was discovered in 1990. Now, verse 14, that is referring to what Caiaphas said back in John chapter 11. He's talking to the council and he said, "You know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man should die for the people and that the whole nation should not perish." Well, looking at the context, he seems to have just been saying that, well, Jesus, he's going to need to be killed to prevent trouble with the Romans. But John told us in chapter 11 that it was actually a prophecy. He just didn't grasp the significance of what he was saying. It was an unintentional prophecy. But here's the thing. It's really hard to expect a fair trial from a man who had already said that putting you to death was expedient. So I think John is simply pointing out here that Jesus, he was condemned even before he was tried. Well, let's continue now with verses 15 through 18 with the first of Peter's denials. And Simon Peter was following Jesus, and so was another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest and entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest, but Peter was standing at the door outside. So the other disciple who was known to the high priest went out and spoke to the doorkeeper and brought in Peter. The slave girl, therefore, who kept the door, said to Peter, "You are not also one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I am not." Now the slaves and the officers were standing there, having made a charcoal fire, for it was cold and they were warming themselves. And Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself. Well, another disciple is generally understood to be John, the author of this gospel, who seems to have preferred to never identify himself by name in his gospel. So, after their initial fleeing, it seems that Peter and John, well, they decided to follow to see what was going to happen. And the other gospels, they only mention Peter and that he was following at a distance. And so maybe they weren't together, since we can see that John got there first. Well, one question that's often asked is, well, how was John known to the high priest? Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that he was his buddy or a personal friend, but he was known well enough to be admitted. Now, some offer that John might have been a relative, you know, of the high priest's family. Others think that, well, John's family might have supplied fish for the high priest's household. You remember, John was a fisherman. There's no way to know. The traditions are varied. Well, the servant girl at the door, She must have been familiar with John, so she let him in. But probably seeing that Peter, he's a stranger, she refused to let him in. Now, we learn from verse 16 that John, well, he had to go all the way back out and ask the servant to let him in. After John spoke to the doorkeeper, well, I suspect he must have gone back in to the hall where Jesus was before Annas. And I don't know, maybe John is admitting here that part of Peter's downfall was his fault, you know, in making sure Peter could get in. As J.W. McGarvey said, John would have shown a truer kindness to Peter had he let him stay out. But of course, he couldn't have known. Well, a question that I have is, why did she ask Peter if he was a disciple of Jesus? From verse 17, it sounds as if she knew that John was as a disciple, because she said, "You are not also one." And so she's therefore suspicious of Peter. Maybe she thought she could get in trouble by letting him in. Or maybe she thought that she could be rewarded for exposing him. Well, all four Gospels tell us that Peter's first challenge, it came from this slave girl, a very unimportant person, and yet that's all it took. Now, in the Greek, according to A.T. Robertson and other Greek scholars, we can see that her question, it expected a negative answer. It expected the answer of no, which if you think about it, that made it that much easier for him to give that answer. Satan will often try to make it as easy as possible for us to sin and to compromise. Well, another question that I have is, how in the world could Peter go from wielding the sword to this? Well, his faith had been shaken. See, Peter, he was confused, he was disillusioned. First, there was Jesus' rebuke. And then, of course, Jesus being arrested, that was something that he never expected. And so it seems that he's only thinking of self-preservation at this point. And he didn't, of course, have the other apostles and Jesus with him. And maybe it had something to do with these unfamiliar surroundings in this very important place. It could also be that his lack of sleep played a part. I mean, people make a lot of mistakes when they are tired. At least I do. Whatever it was, he lost his nerve. We all have times of strength, and we all have times of weakness. And it's in those times of weakness that we need to be very careful. Now, some people try to argue that, well, this didn't come from fear. But why would someone deny Jesus? And why do people lie? It's because they fear the consequences. Richard Lenski explained it like this. What swept Peter off his feet was the suddenness of his exposure, its publicity before the crowd about the fire, and the guilty feeling that he had of his own will and against warning walked into this trap. He was thrown into a panic. Frightened, he saw no way out except to lie. The devil still loves to pounce upon the foolhardy and sweep off their feet those who boast of their strength. And so the man who had previously snatched out his sword is now cringing in lying denial. He said, "I am not." And we learn from Mark that he added, "I neither know nor understand what you're talking about." Look at verse 18. In the firelight, yeah, it would have been easier to recognize him. But maybe he thought that, well, it'd look a little too suspicious if he's hiding away from the fire on a cold night. I don't know. Well, verses 19 through 24, John shifted the scene to the examination of Jesus before Annas. So let's read this. The high priest therefore questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Jesus answered him, "I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together, and I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. Behold, these know what I said." And when he had said this, one of the officers standing by gave Jesus a blow, saying, "Is that the way you answer the high priest?" Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken wrongly, bear witness of the wrong. But if rightly, why do you strike me?" Annas therefore sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. And so John, he supplied here what the other Gospels did not include. And that's the questioning of Annas before Jesus was sent to Caiaphas. Well, we can see from verses 19 and 22 that Annas, he was still given that title of high priest, even though he was really no longer in possession of that office. Well, they're engaging here in what lawyers often call a fishing expedition. Just a grasping at straws and something of a pre-trial investigation. You see, they're trying to get some kind of confession out of him, something out of which that they can frame an accusation. And we learn from Luke's gospel and from a quick statement in Matthew and Mark that the proper trial before the Sanhedrin would not take place until the morning. Well, Jesus, of course, he didn't cooperate. He simply told Annas that he taught publicly. And so Annas should question those who heard him speak. I mean, he hadn't been going around teaching some secret subversive message. He wasn't involved in secret conspiracies. I mean, there's no hidden plotting and scheming. The Sanhedrin, on the other hand, well, they would often conspire in secret, as they had done to arrest him, but not Jesus. I mean, he had spoken in the most public of places, the synagogues and the temple. You know, the synagogues were the local places of Jewish worship. Now, it should have been easy to find witnesses. Multitudes of people had listened to him. They had heard him speaking in public. And the religious leaders, they'd even sent their spies on more than one occasion. And so if he had done wrong, if he had taught seditious doctrines, it was very easy to prove it. If they really wanted truth, oh, there are plenty of witnesses that they could question. But of course, they're not really after truth, are they? They had already made up their minds regardless of the evidence. And sadly, that is the case with many people today. Well, I think Jesus, he's simply pointing out that this questioning, it's superfluous, all right? And maybe that it's not being conducted properly. There needed to be witnesses before one's guilt could be established. Well, I suspect this officer, you know, he probably saw some discomfort on Annas' face with Jesus' response. And so he tried to come to the rescue. And this is the first blow that we know of that Jesus received. He would receive many more before his death. Verse 23, he said, "If I have spoken wrongly, bear witness of the wrong, but if rightly, why do you strike me?" Man, Jesus was cool. That's all I can say. Observe the calmness and the dignity of his response and his reply. Just the self-control and the courage that he always displayed, it's so admirable. And these are things that would normally cause a person to get all stirred up and thrown into a temper. But Jesus, he was dignified, he kept his composure. Well, it seems that Annas, well, he didn't know what to do. So verse 24, Annas therefore sent him bound to Caiaphas the high priest. And so it looks like Annas still had a home in the official residence of the high priest. Now, we don't know for sure, but most of the scholars that I read believe that this is nothing more than moving Jesus from one side of the residence to the other while Peter's in the courtyard. So where was Caiaphas during this time that Jesus was being questioned by Annas? Maybe he hadn't been woken up yet. Or more likely, he was out trying to find some witnesses or trying to gather more of the Sanhedrin. Well, Matthew 26, Mark 14, we learn just what happened while Jesus was before Caiaphas. The council was there, but again, this is not the formal session of the court. That would take place in the morning. We read that, well, they kept trying to get these false witnesses to testify against them, but it wasn't working, and Mark tells us that their testimony was not consistent, and you know, Jesus, he remained silent. And so Caiaphas finally, just point blank, he asked him, he decided to just straight out ask him if he was the Christ, the Son of God. And after he, sure enough, admitted it, we read, "Then the high priest tore his robes," you know, to give it effect, "saying, 'He has blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, you have now heard the blasphemy. What do you think?' They answered and said, 'He is deserving of death.' And they spat in his face and beat him with their fists. And others slapped him and said, 'Prophesy to us, you Christ, who was the one who hit you?'" Well, next, In verses 25 through 27, John, he took us back to Peter in the courtyard. And some people, they suspect that John intertwined these to contrast the courage of Jesus next to the lack of courage in Peter. Or maybe just to add dramatic effect. Either way, I really like the way he did it. So let's read. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. They said therefore to him, "You are not also one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." One of the slaves of the high priest, being a relative of the one whose ear Peter cut off, said, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" Peter therefore denied it again, and immediately a cock crowed. Now again, this question of verse 25, it anticipated the answer, no, and again Peter took the easy way out and he lied. And you'll notice that John said they, implying more than one. Well, the NIV Study Bible makes this comment. Some find a difficulty in that Matthew 26:71 says another girl asked this question, whereas Mark 14:69 says it was the same girl, and Luke 22:58 that it was a man. But with a group of servants talking around a fire, several would doubtless take up and repeat such a question, which could be the meaning of John's they. And so it's possible that that servant girl at the door, she got a few other people, and then they confronted him again. And of course, some people ask, well, why don't all the Gospels say it just alike? But to add or to include additional information, that doesn't amount to a contradiction. For example, I mean, such variation is observed in the lecture notes taken by students in a classroom. I mean, some include more information and more details than others, but that doesn't mean that they're not all equally valid witnesses to what the instructor said. I mean, the same is true when it comes to eyewitnesses of a crime or an accident. I mean, different things stand out to them. And so these little things in the Gospels like this, it shows us that there was no collusion. You know, secretly getting together to make sure their stories are all straight. They either just included or left out certain details. As Simon Greenleaf, one of the founders of Harvard Law School, said of the Gospel writers, "There is enough of a discrepancy to show that there could have been no previous concert among them, and at the same time, such substantial agreement as to show that they all were independent narrators of the same great transaction." Well, we learn from Luke that an hour had passed between the second and the third denials. And since verses 25 and 26 seem to go together, that causes some scholars to think that this is the same instance of denial and that John, he just didn't record the second confrontation and denial. And I guess that's possible, but not necessarily so. Now, looking at this third question in the Greek, unlike the others, it expects the answer, yes. And this might have added to his fear, because if he was identified as the one who had resisted arrest and attacked Malchus, there might have been grounds, solid grounds for his arrest now. And we learn from the other Gospels that Peter's Galilean accent, that was also mentioned as evidence here. You know, he kept saying y'all without realizing it. And so he denied it again. And Matthew and Mark add that he began to curse and swear, "I do not know this man you are talking about." Not speaking of profanities, but putting himself under a curse if he was lying, which is pretty amazing, actually. It's been said that one lie compels others until the liar is submerged. So three times he is guilty of lying and disloyalty. Surely Peter was there when Jesus said, "Whoever shall deny me before men, I will also deny him before my Father who is in heaven." Many, like Peter, they weaken and they fail to declare the truth about their belief in Jesus when it's not popular. It says an immediately a cock crowed. Now, the significance of this, of course, is found back in chapter 13. Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, where are you going?" Jesus answered, "Where I go, you cannot follow me now, but you shall follow later." Peter said to him, "Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for you." Jesus answered, "Will you lay down your life for me? Truly, truly, I say to you, a cock shall not crow until you deny me three times. And in Mark's gospel, we learn that there were actually two crowings, and Jesus had actually specified two. Now, again, there's no contradiction. It's just more information added in Mark. Well, I find this interesting. Some scholars don't think that this cock crow was a rooster. They think that it was the Roman trumpet call for the third watch of the night to mark the changing of the guard, which was sometimes called cock crow. No idea. Well, after the cock crowed, Luke 22, it says, "And the Lord turned and looked at Peter, and Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had told him, 'Before a cock crows today, you will deny me three times.' And he went out and wept bitterly." It's much better to remember the word of the Lord before we sin. Now, I assume this look happened as they were transferring Jesus to a guard room, or as they were moving him to the official trial at the council chambers. And I've read that there were legal restrictions forbidding trials at night, and that they couldn't condemn a man to death at night. And so this questioning before Annas and then Caiaphas was, like I said, it was simply a fishing expedition. It was trying to figure out how to condemn him in the morning. So, looking at this section of Scripture, combining last week and this week, well, we see the mistakes of two of his followers. The difference is, Judas went out and hanged himself, as we learn from Matthew's gospel, and Peter repented. Well, let's talk about these two guys for a minute. Now, like I said last week, the next time a friend stabs you in the back, just remember that Jesus, he knows exactly what that's like. Well, as we can see from John 12 at Bethany, Judas, the guy was a thief, and his true love was money. And so, like so many throughout the history of the world, Judas sold his soul for a bit of money. Peter, on the other hand, he was crushed by a simple look from Jesus. And this is something to keep in mind. Jesus may not physically turn and look at us after we sin, but he does see us. We all mess up from time to time. And sometimes, like Peter, we fall hard. What does God want from us? 2 Corinthians 7:10, "For the sorrow that is according to the will of God produces a repentance without regret, leading to salvation. But the sorrow of the world produces death." Have you ever done something so bad that you wanted to just run away and hide? You know, you wanted to crawl into a hole never to return. Peter, he could have run away. He could have fallen into drugs and alcohol. Or he could have hanged himself like Judas. But he didn't. So like Peter, we need to mourn for our sins and then get back up and continue on. But again, it is much better to remember the words of the Lord before we sin. We're never to deny that we are a disciple of Jesus. If we're ashamed of him, he'll be ashamed of us. Now, I want to conclude with a suggestion from David Lipscomb that I thought was helpful. John entered as a friend of Jesus. Peter, in his fear after what had passed, sought to pass as a stranger. The temptation came upon him much stronger than if he had at once declared himself the friend of Jesus. The man who declares himself as the friend of Jesus and walks closest to him finds fewer temptations to deny him and greater help to stand with him.